Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg-Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. My name is Michael Welch. On today's show...
I think their vision of a world is very homogenous, is very white, doesn't include queer folk, so that's a big concern.
These fish farms have to be moved out of our waters. We have no time left to worry about the court system, the government system.
We've been building this community for so many years. It's easily destroyed by timber creek. It's unacceptable.
But first, here are the headlines. From Montreal, on the unceded territory of the Mohawk, CKUT's Julia Bougil brings us this report on one elected official's response to the community's calls for safer housing in the city.
On Thursday, June 28th, Valérie Plante and members of her team staged a press conference to announce their new strategy for safe housing. Addressing a need for better enforcement of housing regulations for both landlords and tenants, she's more than doubled her inspection force, tripled the four-year target for inspections, committed to making data public, and more. The press conference was held in Côte des Neiges with Côte des Neiges NDG Mayor Sue Montgomery and Côte des Neiges City Councillor Magda Poponon both present. The area houses many low-income residents and is increasingly plagued by evictions and unsafe living conditions.
This action plan focuses on four main elements. The first one is prevention. The second one is how to give better support. The third one is control. And the fourth one is transparency.
At the press conference, Plante spoke a lot about the specific action plan, but did not meaningfully address the issue of the powerful landlords who exert lots of control over the lives of tenants and even city officials in neighborhoods like Côte des Neiges. But even if renovations are completed, tenants' lives won't automatically improve. Instead, they can then be evicted as rents rise along with living standards, writes the advocacy group Le Front d'Action Populaire et Réaménagement Urbain in a press release about the action plan. For them, it is essential for the city to include a plan to protect tenants in these scenarios.
That report was provided by Julia Bougil of CKUT in Montreal on unceded Mohawk territory. Catherine Fisher of CJLY on Sinaixt traditional territory in rural BC brings us the following headline about a five-year-old environmental disaster and the frustrated efforts of one affected resident to hold the company responsible to account.
5 years ago, a tanker truck took a wrong turn onto an interior BC logging road and spilled 33,000 liters of jet fuel into Lemon Creek in the Slocan Valley, resulting in a mass evacuation and orders not to swim in or drink from the creek or the nearby Slocan River. In 2014, saying she was tired of government inaction in laying charges related to the spill, Slocan Valley resident Marilyn Burgoon launched a private prosecution against Calgary-based Executive Flight Center and against the BC government for violating Fisheries Act provisions. In 2016, the federal government took over Burgoon's prosecution and added charges against the driver of the truck. The case again made its way through BC courts and came to trial in fall of 2017. Here's Marilyn Burgoon on what happened next.
The outcome of the case was that the driver ended up with the only charges. Executive Flight, their charges were stayed, and they were stayed due to the Jordan rule. You have to be before the courts within 18 months. And Executive Flight argued that the clock should start ticking when the private prosecution began. As most people know, before people are busted, they do the investigation in order to have the evidence to go and bust you. It's different with an environmental case. You have to do the investigation after. You can't really charge them till you know you have a case. So if you file a private prosecution and the investigation takes longer than 18 months, they get off. So that's why this is a very important appeal, and I've applied for intervener status.
We'll update Groundwire listeners on the appeal as it goes forward. This is Catherine Fisher reporting for Groundwire from Sinaixt Traditional Territory in southeastern BC. Thanks to Keith Wiley and the Ecocentric on Kootenai Co-op Radio for files.
Concerned community members supporting migrant justice and outraged by U.S. border officials separating children from their migrant parents at the Mexico border rallied in front of the U.S. Embassy in downtown Winnipeg on Saturday, June 30th. Consistent with similar events on what organizers call a Keeping Families Together Day of Action, the gathering not only called on the Trudeau government to condemn the U.S. border policy, but also sought to rectify immigration procedures within Canada itself. Hazim Ismail is a refugee to Canada and one of the presenters at the June 30th rally.
In Canada, you can detain immigrants without charge indefinitely, whereas in the U.S. previously, it would be 6 months. If there was no charge, you'd have to let the migrant go, right? But in Canada, it's always been indefinitely. And now the U.S. is actually being inspired by Canada to be even more extreme.
Among other concerns raised by organizers, the separation of First Nations children from their birth parents through residential schools, the 60s Scoop, and modern child welfare agencies, the temporary foreign workers program, which separates families working in Canada from their children for years on end, the need to revoke the Safe Third Country Agreement, which blocks asylum seekers from the U.S. from entering Canada at official ports of entry, and the imperial policies which displace people in the Global South in the first place. To read the full list of demands, please visit the Facebook page for Families Belong Together Day of Action. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. You just heard Indian City with the song Take Me Home from their 2016 album Here and Now. Now it's time for our feature stories. Anti-racism organizers mobilized on the streets of Montreal in response to a planned Canada Day march by the group calling itself La Meute. CKUT's Julia Bougil provides some background and brings us some of the voices from that event.
On Sunday, outside the Citizenship and Immigration Offices of Montreal's Place du Canada, Quebecois nationalist organization La Meute rallied for the first time in over a year. They used a scorching hot Canada Day as an opportunity to decry illegal immigration. They were met in force by anti-fascist counter-protesters who came across the city in Place Valois and traveled to join La Meute roughly half an hour into their demonstration, moving through the streets to counter the group from different sides. I spoke with a few of the counter-protesters on why they see La Meute as so dangerous and why they were compelled to demonstrate against them. So what are you doing out here today?
Well, my friends and I initially came out for the Place Valois demonstration because we live a few blocks from there, and La Meute was coming into our neighborhood, and so we were very concerned about having sort of fascists in our neighborhood. And then we heard that they moved their location, so here we are. It's really important for us to make a very clear message to racists, transphobes, Nazis, that they're not welcome in our neighborhood, in our cities, and that we won't tolerate their presence. You know, they try to sort of avoid being a little too explicit, but it's clear to me that, I mean, first and foremost, I think it's Muslim-focused. I think they have a problem with sort of a society where you can have different people with differences. I think their vision of a world is very homogenous, is very white, doesn't include queer folk. And so that's a big concern.
So it's Canada Day, they're rallying today, and they've been chanting, "We are not fascists." How would you respond to that?
If you have to say you're not a fascist, that probably means that you're a fascist. That's pathetic.
So why are you here today?
It just feels really important, especially with things that are happening internationally and in the States right now. Like, we like to think that Canada's better, but it isn't. And protests like the one that we're trying to counter today are an example of that. So I think it's important to let people know that they can't get away with acting like this in Canada or anywhere, necessarily. Yeah, I think what allows events like this to happen is people thinking that they're supported anyway socially when they take stances like this against immigrants, and that we just like have to let them know that that's not acceptable.
And so how would you portray a group like Lemets?
I mean, they like to say that they're nonviolent and that they're protesting nonviolently, but when your organization stands for violence against people, nothing you do is peaceful. Definitely they're a super Islamophobic organization, and they're against the increase of immigration into Quebec. And this definitely isn't the way to support refugees or immigrants one way or the other. Like, they say that they're trying to make things better for people on both sides of the border, but that's incorrect. Like, this is not the way to support anybody. I think Quebec is an interesting situation in Canada because people tend to be a lot more vocal one way or the other. I think the radical far left here is a lot more vocal and active, but that means so is the far right. And I think that comes from a lot of kind of historical and political reasons.
So what brought you here today?
So I was born here. I've lived in Quebec my whole life, and I think there's a very troubling history of far-right, extremely racist groups in Quebec making their voices heard under the guise of nationalism, under the guise of protecting a sort of specific Francophone white identity. I think that's bullshit. I think it's just racism, and I think we need to make that very clear. I've definitely felt like they're more emboldened these past few years. I think some things have been a bit dormant for a while, and now they're making themselves heard again, and they're being extremely vocal, but it's nothing new. It's just loud now. I think part of it is deconstructing the absolutely fake notion that Francophone Quebecois white people are colonized or were colonized. I think a lot of it has to do with reckoning with the fact that we're part of the history of colonization and that we have no more right to be here than the rest of Canada.
Thanks again to Julia Bougil from radio station CKUT for that report. On June 20th, the BC provincial government announced it would allow contentious fish farm tenures to be renewed, subject to monthly review, through 2022. A determined group of salmon proponents gathered on the legislative grounds in Victoria to voice their rejection of the NDP position. Chris Cook of University of Victoria-based CFUV brings us some of those voices.
This government has done nothing but being deceitful to us as salmon people. We need these fish farms out of our waters. There is no second choice. There is no third choice. These fish farms have to get on land. That's the only acceptable answer.
Well, it's June 20th. I'm down at the legislature building. The NDP promised an announcement on the tenure of fish farms. Can you tell me what your name is and why you're here today?
Yes, my name is Tsequelis, and I'm here about the fish farms. I have been up at Swanson Fish Farm for the last 2 months. Before that, outside Horgan's office for 2 months, DFO for a month. And with this announcement coming out in bits and pieces, starting with the press release that was given with Horgan and Olson inside the legislative building, and all indications were that this government is not listening to us at all about anything. They're still going ahead and calling it a month-to-month and talking about the year 2022, which is totally unacceptable. We won't accept that at all. These fish farms have to be moved out of our waters. We have no time left to worry about the court system, the government system. Everything that's been put together has been put together as a stall tactic by this government.
Can you tell me your name and why you're here today?
My name is James Smith, and I'm here because these fish farms are on my territory. I'm a Mumptigila, and this decision basically holds no weight on that fish farm that's in my territory, because that chief, the Tlaalwisi's chief, claims that land, and he is okay with the fish farms, but the people aren't. Plenty of the people aren't. So it's this consent thing is just a bogus PR move, you know. Holds no weight for me or my people. And one fish farm on this coast is going to affect the entire run. So it's saying, oh, we'll take a couple of these out. It's just it's too much of a safe move.
Well, the cynical response is justified, and again, on top of what was decided for Site C, too.
Yeah. It's just more punting, pushing the blame onto other people.
Blame the past and kick the issue into the future.
Exactly. Yeah. It means nothing. It holds no weight in reality.
So what's going to happen next, then?
I guess we'll see. You know, more resistance, and it doesn't mean anything for us in hindering our energy at all for this movement at all, because we're strong, fast, sit fast against this.
Thanks, James. Can you tell me your name and why you're here?
My name is Joan Lemmers, and I'm here because I want to have wild salmon in British Columbia.
And what's that got to do with the fish farms?
Well, we believe that the fish farms have parasites, and they also have, we know positively, they have sea lice. And I used to commercial fish for a living, and there are lice occurring naturally, and we would see one or two lice on a pink salmon. And then as the farms went in, we saw more and more lice, like up to 20, 25 on one pink salmon eating into their flesh. So we know that is a huge problem.
Satsikalis Ambers again.
This government has never listened to us. And then they throw in the word consultation, and they throw in the word reconciliation. These are all buzzwords that don't mean a thing. We're not going to stand down. We're not going to accept this at all. Our people will actively be on top of the fish farms. Our position has never changed, and it won't change, even if they did follow the month to month. That's not acceptable at all. We need a timetable. We need to see a concrete plan of dismantling these fish farms.
So once again, the NDP and John Horgan have disappointed First Nations and environmentalists who would like to see an end to the fish farms here in British Columbia. For Groundwire, this is Chris Cook in Victoria.
Voices heard in that feature included Kwakwaka Wak grandmother Tsatsil Kwelis Ambers, salmon protector James Smith, and former fisher Joan Lemmers. In our final feature, we profile a group in Ottawa trying to stop what's being called the largest mass eviction in Canada, one that principally targets the racialized and non-English as a first language population. Issues of gentrification and affordable housing are in play in this story, brought to us by Neil Rockwell of Montreal-based CKUT.
Heron Gate is Ottawa's most diverse neighborhood, being listed by Statistics Canada as more than 70% visible minority. The section between Heron and Walkley Roads is owned almost exclusively by one landlord, Timber Creek Asset Management. This portion is home to 4,000 people. Heron Gate was built in the 1960s by Minto. In 2007, they sold it to Transglobe Properties. Heron Gate has been in decline for decades, but things became much worse after the sale, with Transglobe massively neglecting the properties and refusing to do maintenance work. In 2013, Heron Gate was sold to Timber Creek, who in terms of maintenance were a slight improvement but continued to neglect buildings and were slow to perform maintenance, not fixing roofs, allowing mold to proliferate, replacing broken appliances with appliances from neighboring abandoned homes rather than buying new ones, and so forth. It should be noted that on my trips to Heron Gate, I've observed numerous violations of standards of maintenance bylaws. The complex is riddled with leaking roofs, vermin, trash, mold, and more. In 2016, Timber Creek demolished 83 townhomes, citing structural problems with the buildings. They are now building luxury high-rises in place of those units. Many of those tenants were moved to other properties in the Heron Gate complex, into homes which, this May, Timber Creek informed residents will soon be demolished to make way for more high-end units. In total, Timber Creek is now demolishing 150 units, 105 of which are currently occupied. The rest are currently abandoned. One such resident facing eviction for a second time in 2 years is Abdullahi Ali. Heron Gate is home to a very large Somali community.
This is the second time being evicted. We've been affected before 2-3 years ago. It's a lot of stress, and sometimes we cannot sleep even the whole night. It's really, really painful and very disgusting. They wanted to demolish these houses and spread all this community over different corners of the city. Yeah, that's too sad. We've been building this community for so many years, and it's destroyed by Timber Creek. It's unacceptable.
Many tenants, Ellie included, who feel that this neglect has been intentional, are organizing against Timber Creek. They have formed the Herongate Tenants Coalition with the intention of preserving their homes and community. The UN has taken an interest. Leilani Farha, the UN Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, spoke at a recent tenants' meeting, explaining how mass evictions are a human rights violation and how, under international law, governments and developers have a duty to create a plan with current residents.
Forced evictions are considered a gross violation of human rights, which means it's like the worst kind of violation of human rights that can happen. Under international human rights law, forced evictions should not happen, period, ever. There is a responsibility on the part of government to make sure that every alternative to the eviction is explored.
Timber Creek has tried to give the impression that they are helping residents relocate. But tenants I have spoke with say that Timber Creek has done nothing. Their relocation consultant is an engineering student, the son of one of the property managers. One of their flyers gave such advice as searching the terms home and rent on sites like Kijiji and Craigslist. Apart from the destruction of their community, many residents I've spoken with talk about the anxiety and sleepless nights they've experienced thinking about where they will go and what they will do, since all of the houses available are way out of their budget in the difficult Ottawa housing market. Many families will face homelessness. Amina Sheikh Ahmed told me that her mother will lose her business.
My mom owns a home daycare, and this is her source of income, and so we are being forced to move out, which will leave her jobless.
On top of this, I have been getting numerous reports of residents being intimidated and receiving false information from the property manager, Paul Boutros. According to several accounts, he has targeted people with poor English skills, telling them their locks will be changed and their things thrown out, in one case leaving a resident in tears. Resident Mohammed Iman discusses.
Yes, the management here. The manager, and I don't know the lady, but the ball is the manager. They harassing people that they don't know good English.
Another resident recently said that Boutros told him that resistance was hopeless because Timber Creek already possessed demolition permits. This is untrue because permits can only be issued once residents are vacated and all utilities disconnected. Another important issue is Timber Creek's rationale for why they must demolish these homes. In a vaguely worded notice to residents dated May 7th, 2018, they explained that these homes are, quote, reaching the end of their building life cycle, unquote. 50 years, however, does not seem particularly old for a building. And this also raises the question of why these particular units and not the others in the complex which were built at the same time. Nonetheless, tenants have the impression that their homes are to be demolished because they are no longer structurally sound. Yet no one I spoke with can remember Timber Creek ever sending anyone to inspect the state of their home. Here's Herongate resident Tracy Heal.
In the 4 years that I've lived there, not once have they come by to have an inspection done. I'm not sure how they can claim that they're not livable if they've never seen what they look like.
Furthermore, a close reading of the May 7th notice reveals that Timber Creek themselves never explicitly cite structural concerns, instead using the much more ambiguous term viability. To quote, the long-term viability of the low-rise wood structure homes in this area is compromised. It has reached the point that the townhomes in this area will need to be demolished at the end of 2018, unquote. This raises questions about why this demolition needs to take place and why it must be carried out in such a rapid manner. In a post to the CTV Ottawa website, Timber Creek suggested that the timetable for the previous eviction was inflexible because residents had to be moved out before the city would issue demolition permits. This suggests that the timetable for eviction need not be as inflexible as Timber Creek indicates, and that development with direct input by residents is possible. For more information, please visit herongatetenants.ca and Herongate Tenant Coalition on Facebook. Follow on Instagram and Twitter with the handle at HerongateTC. Reporting from CKUT in Montreal, this is Neil Rockwell for Groundwire.
You are listening to Groundwire, community news broadcasting from coast to coast to coast, and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. Now it's time for our community radio report. It has been a common ritual in Canadian cities to send youngsters off to camp during the summer months. Winnipeg's CKUW 95.9 FM contributes to this tradition by offering its physical location and space on the airwaves for downtown area youth to explore the rough and rustic landscape of radio as a site for their growth and recreation in August. Most years, the camp would run for about 3 weeks, with a different group of kids stepping up each week. This year, due to a shortfall in funding, the camp will only run for 2 weeks. We spoke with the longtime coordinator, who is getting ready for CKUW Radio Camp 2018.
I'm Jay Vandeventer. I'm the director of Radio Camp with CKUW. And the focus of the camp is to have kids come down on Monday, and then by Friday they produce and perform their own radio show. So what I do as well is I developed a curriculum and we go over the various things you can do on radio as well. And we do pre-records. I show them basics of editing. I teach them interview skills. And overall, it's pretty fun. And the stuff the kids come up with is pretty awesome. They're very creative and very funny.
So is it basically just an educational session about radio?
It's educational, but it's also we try to have fun too. It is summertime. Kids want to have fun, so we do go to the park here and there. We do some fun things outside of the station. But generally what we do is we just have fun with it. And, when we do interview skills, it's pretty funny because I try to teach the kids to, ask questions that people won't really expect, because I usually have them ask adults questions, And, a lot of the times the kids will just ask the general, who are you, where are you from? But I like to get them to throw in some curveballs to get adults off guard.
You want to be really strong or eat 15 horses?
I would rather be really strong. I don't have much interest in eating raw animal. I appreciate the being asked.
We have cut down from 3 weeks to 2 weeks, and it's doable, but the program is very popular that I'm basically... Registration has been open for a month and I'm almost at capacity. I'm almost got the shutdown. So I know I could for sure do 3 weeks, maybe even four. But what it really boils down to is the funding.
Hmm. Were there any particularly memorable moments?
A kid in the cafeteria started a fire. So that was pretty memorable. He was curious and he saw a burner and he threw a napkin on it. And all of a sudden we're going and I saw the corner of my eye, a fire had started in the cafeteria. So... that was a memorable moment. One memorable moment, I know there's one boy that's come to camp since he was probably 10, but now he's about 14 or so. Last year, he gave us a note saying that radio camp helped him with his self-esteem and confidence, and he was really thankful for it. And when I read that note, that really, as an educator, that really warmed my heart. So that would be probably next to the fire my most memorable moment. The kids seem to really like it. They find it really fun. They like, being creative, making stuff, making new friends too. Families love hearing the program as well. Just overall, the community seems to really enjoy what we do. Sometimes it can be serious. It's mostly pretty funny, but even the serious stuff is entertaining. Like, it's just an entertaining program that they put on every year. Like, I've never been disappointed.
This year's camp takes place August 13th to 17th and August 20th to 24th, with special radio broadcasts airing on the Fridays at 1 p.m. local time. For more details and to listen to previous broadcasts, please visit ckuwradiocamp.ca. That was your community radio report. We'll be right back after this. Just heard Sun Tries from the Young Pixels from their album Fever of Becoming. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Mihiyawak and the Nakota. Headlines this week were written by Julia Bougil, Catherine Fisher, and Michael Welch. We also thank Julia Bougil, Chris Cook, and Neil Rockwell for their contributions, and a special thanks to Greg McDougall for his assistance with our third feature story. Music this week was from Indian City and from the Young Pixels. For CKUW, I've been your host, Michael Welch. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download it at groundwire.ca.